throughout the world in places where children have ample opportunities to play. They play at all the basic skills that are important to humans everywhere.
You're listening to the Mindful Mama podcast, episode number 373. Today, we're talking about how to help your child learn with Dr. Peter Gray. Welcome to the Mindful Mama podcast. Here, it's about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. At Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have, and when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm your host, Hunter Clark Fields. I help smart, thoughtful parents stay calm so they can have strong, connected relationships with their children. I've been practicing mindfulness for over 20 years. I'm the creator of Mindful Parenting, and I'm the author of the best-selling book, Raising Good Humans, a mindful guide to breaking the cycle of reactive parenting and raising kind, confident kids. Welcome back to the Mindful Mama podcast, dear listener. Hey, if you haven't done so, please hit that subscribe button so you don't ever miss one of these episodes. And if you've ever gotten some value from this podcast, please go over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and review. It just helps the podcast grow more. All of our growth so far has been organic, and it's because of you. It takes 30 seconds. I greatly appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. In just a moment, I'm going to be sitting down with Dr. Peter Gray, author of introductory psychology textbook, research articles in neuroscience, psychology, anthropology, and education, author of the book Free to Learn, a book about children's natural capacities for self-directed education. And we're going to talk about education today quite a bit. And I think many of us are confused about what to do about our kids' education. Should they go to the local school? Should they go to a private school? Should we homeschool? So I brought Peter Gray on so that we could talk about how kids learn and what kind of education best supports their healthy development. You're going to find out what you should and should not do to help your child have a meaningful education that keeps their natural curiosity alive. Now join me at the table as I talk to Dr. Peter Gray.
Are you struggling with kids fighting, yelling, and more despite listening to the podcast and reading all the books? Parenting can be so overwhelming and exhausting. You know, I see you and I have something that will help. Mindful Parenting SOS. I'm offering free live mindful parenting sessions starting Monday, May 6th. Basically, live mindful parenting lessons that you normally have to pay for. So if you struggle with getting your kids to listen, tantrums, misbehavior, and feeling the guilt of yelling at your kid, then you should definitely get your spot in Mindful Parenting SOS. I'll be there to answer your questions in person, and if you can't make it, we will have replays available. Don't wait to get your spot now. It's free. Go to mindfulmamamentor.com/SOS to register. That's mindfulmamamentor.com/SOS. I can't wait to see you there.
You, like me, are a speaker at the Parenting Unconference that we're at this November 2022, and you're going to be teaching about play. And you talk about how there is a crisis in play for kids. Can you just describe the lay of the land, what's been happening for kids' play over the last number of years?
Yeah, well, of course, most of my research is in the United States, but the same is true in much of the rest of the developed world. There has been a huge decline over decades in children's opportunities to play. You know, children are really designed to grow by playing. That's, you know, the natural selection endowed them with this extraordinarily strong drive to play and to play in certain ways. And throughout human history, we have largely respected that. There have been times when we haven't, when we had children working in sweatshops and coal mines, and that still happens in some places. But largely, children, most people in most parts of the world throughout human history have understood that children need lots of time to play. Play is how they develop social skills. It's how they develop creativity. It's how they develop the ability to control their emotions. It's how they develop building skills because they play a constructive play. It's how they learn about, it's how they practice the skills that are important to their culture, because children everywhere play at the skills that are important to their culture. But during the period of my lifetime, my adult lifetime, we have seen in the United States and in the UK and many other places, a huge decline in the opportunities for children to play. We have more or less taken over children's lives. Play is something that children need to do independently of adults. Adults interfere with it. Adults ruin children's play by intervening, by controlling, and so on and so forth. So children need independent time away from adults with other kids in order to play. And we're just not providing that for kids anymore. We are taking up their time with way too much schooling. We're burning kids out with too much schooling. We're making them cynical about schooling even while they're still in elementary school. That didn't used to happen until they reached middle school. We are driving them crazy with standardized testing and comparing them all the time. We're giving them the message that if they don't do well on these tests, they're somehow failures in life. We're making them anxious and nervous about all of this. We have record levels of anxiety and depression among school-age children. This is what we're doing. We're doing it with, I must say, good intentions. People genuinely believe that all this, quote, schooling is education, if you want to call it that, but I would call it schooling, is good for kids. We also are overprotecting children from good intentions. We don't want our children to get hurt. We don't want them to suffer emotional pain or physical pain. So we guard them all the time. And as a consequence of that, children are not learning how to be independent. They're not playing. They're not exploring. They're not having the opportunity, I would say, to grow up. The purpose of childhood is to become increasingly independent. That's why we have such a long childhood. It takes a long time for human beings to acquire the kinds of characteristics, personality characteristics, the kinds of skills, kind of character traits that allow for successful adulthood. Those are developed if we allow children, as they're growing up, increasing amounts of independence. But we are not currently doing that, and we are seeing the consequences of it.
It's a scary picture. I mean, and it's interesting because you have talked about how there was a big change in the 1980s, and it's really interesting, like, from my point of view, I was a kid in the 80s. I was born in 1978, and I had a lot of independence as a child. I met my oldest friend, who's still friends with me, when I was four and I was like wandering around on my street singing the Annie song, and I just went home with them. And then, and I wandered, you know, we went to all over the neighborhood. We went up to buy candy, and we did all kinds of things and downtown and all these things. And I did a lot of biking widely and had a lot of independence. And then I met a friend and when I was, I don't know, 10 or something. And she was a little older than me. She was maybe 12, and she was not allowed to leave her driveway. And I was just shocked at this. You know, I had been leaving my driveway forever. I could not understand what was her mother so afraid of, that she was older and she could be babysitting other kids and she wasn't allowed to leave her driveway. And you have talked about how this was a turning point, right? The 1980s was kind of a turning point for the a culture of fear with parents, wasn't it?
I think that's right. I think the it's been a gradual change, really, since the 1950s, or certainly since the 1960s, all the way through now. But I think the 1980s was probably the biggest slope of change. I think there's two things that happened in the 1980s that led to that change. One was the fact that there were a couple of boys, white boys, young white boys, who were kidnapped. At least one of them was killed, and this made the huge impact on the news. This was greatly publicized. It led to public service announcements to the effect of, do you know where your child is right now? And the implication is, if you don't know that, you're probably a negligent parent. It led to pictures of missing children on milk cartons. So you'd be eating your breakfast cereal and seeing these pictures
that.
Of these cute kids who presumably were snatched away by some stranger on the street. Turns out somebody did a retrospective study of that, and it turns out most of those kids were runaways, and any that were snatched away were not snatched away by strangers, but by relatives. So the but we developed the view in the 1980s that it's terribly dangerous out there, that you are a negligent parent if you allow your children the kinds of freedom that parents always allowed in the past, and that so that was a turning point. The other thing is there was a shift in education at that time. There was we began to focus on testing, on standardized testing. We began to get concerned with the PISA scores, how American children's score stand compared to Asian children on these test scores. And the nature of school changed. And so recesses were greatly reduced. Homework was added to even elementary school days, even though, which it hadn't been before. So we began to devote more and more of children's time to schooling, and the worst kind of schooling, the preparation for tests, the least creative thing you can possibly be doing in school. The least intellectually stimulating thing you can possibly be doing in school with them. But that's what we began, because we felt like our national interest somehow depended on squeezing the highest possible test scores we can out of children. We were ignoring the fact that people in China and most of the rest of East Asia were beginning to study our school system, because they realized that they were driving the creativity out of their kids and they needed to loosen up somehow. They needed to offer more opportunities for play. They still haven't succeeded in that, but they've been moving at least in that direction. They've been trying to move in that direction for a long time. So at the same time we were trying to imitate them, they were trying to capture what we had before, which is more looseness, more opportunity for self-direction, more opportunity for creativity, more opportunity to develop the kinds of skills that we have to say are really the skills that are most important today. We don't need people who can memorize a lot of stuff, a couple of clicks on this thing and you can find the answer to whatever you want. You don't have to hold it in your head. We don't need people who can just crunch numbers. We've got calculators and computers. We need people who can be creative. We need people who can solve problems that haven't been solved before. And yet our school system has gone in the exact opposite direction. And by depriving children of play, we're depriving them of the primary way that children learn to be creative and to take initiative and to develop the kinds of skills that would lead them to have success in today's economic world.
I know it kills the love of learning, and I want to get back to this because this is an important thing for me. But they're giving homework now in kindergarten, which is so crazy.
Even in kindergarten, I know. I've heard of it in preschool.
It's nuts. Peter, you would love this. Last night, I was looking at the New York Times, and they had an article about these two boys who are 11 and 9 in 1967, who took a principal told the mother that your son can't read a map, and they've worked it out. So they took a pony cart from Boston, Mass to the Montreal World's Fair in 1967. It took them like 20 days to go on this pony cart. It was sort of controversial and wonderful, for some people then, even then, they were told the mother was told she was a negligent mother, and some people said you're doing a wonderful thing. But I thought, oh my gosh, what a different world, that you could take this pony cart and you would not be arrested. The parents would not be arrested and go to Montreal with this 9 and 11 year old. It was fascinating. But
right.
The thing about the thing that I going back to schooling, the thing that I think about that is that, you know, I was like one of those kids, like a really smart kid who loved to learn, who hated school. I hated school so much, you know, because you all had to sit in a row and we all had to do multiplication on the worksheet when, you know, when I didn't want to do that. And so that was for me a really big when I studied education in graduate school, I learned about homeschooling, I learned about unschooling, learned about a lot of different things, and I learned about Montessori. And for me, the idea that my kids could make a lot of their own choices and they could, you know, they could be much more directive and things like that. And I wouldn't just like kill that like love of learning that was what I really wanted to do, was to not kill that love of learning, which it seems like all that direction of like so much testing and things like that, it really just squashes. It makes learning into this like work, which as you write about, it shouldn't be.
Right. I think that's right. I think that when we talk about love of learning too, I think we need to be a little bit careful about what we mean by that, I'm not sure that all kids love learning, but I think they all love doing, and they learn by doing things. They learn by doing things, and they learn in order to do things. And I'm the same way. I can't honestly say I love learning for its own sake. You know, I love doing things. I love accomplishing things. I love exploring things. But to love learning in the abstract is not something that is very meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a phrase that comes from schooling. like learning is the goal. No, learning is not the goal. The goal is the ability to live your life. The goal is the ability to do things. The goal is to satisfy your curiosity about things that you're curious about.
That's the word I think that is probably more appropriate, is that curiosity. Right. I don't want it to squash their curiosity.
Right. I mean, one of the reasons I'm saying this is John Holt, who you probably know something about his work, in his book on how children learn, he makes the point that never ask a child what the child learned. That's a meaningless question to them. Ask them what they did, and then you may get an answer if they're willing to tell you, because they know what they did. They're concerned about doing things, and they learn by doing things.
Parents, we have to stop the sleep deprivation thing. It is not good for us and is not good for our kids. And you know what is the loveliest form of self-care is that you make a beautiful, inviting bed with incredible bedding. And that's why I love that Cozy Earth is the sponsor of the Mindful Parenting podcast, because Cozy Earth offers bedding products that will transform your sleep. These sheets are so high quality, so soft. They would just be the cure to some sleep deprivation, I swear. Cozy Earth bedding is temperature regulating. It has superior softness, unparalleled fabric, materials, and weave. It has real quality and longevity. All of their products come with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. Incorporating Cozy Earth products into your self-care routine can enhance your sleep quality and your overall wellness. Treat yourself to the ultimate in comfort and indulgence with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear, and prioritize your self-care and sleep health. You deserve it. The promo code that we have just for our listeners is MINDFUL35 for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. Cozy Earth is soft as a mother's touch. Honestly, treat yourself. Go for a really incredible sleep and bedding. Head over to CozyEarth.com and use the promo code MINDFUL35 for an exclusive 35% off. Soft as a mother's touch, Cozy Earth wishes you a happy Mother's Day.
Hey there, I'm Debbie Reber, the founder of Tilt Parenting and the author of the book Differently Wired. The mission of Tilt is to change the way neurodivergence, whether that's having a learning disability, having ADHD, being gifted, autistic, or some combination of all of the above, is perceived and experienced, so differently wired kids and the parents like us raising them can truly thrive. On the Tilt Parenting podcast, I get to talk with authors, therapists, educators, and parenting experts who are committed to this mission. I ask the questions my listeners are most curious about when it comes to supporting our kids. And in turn, my guests share strategies for challenges, out-of-the-box ideas for navigating school, best practices for therapies, tips for advocating, and so many thoughtful insights on what it really takes to help our kids grow up feeling seen and respected so they can create awesome lives for themselves. I know that raising a differently wired kid can feel overwhelming and isolating, but I promise you, you are not alone, and it can feel so much better. If you're on this parenting journey, come listen to Tilt Parenting. Together, we can shift this paradigm and show up for our exceptional kids with hope, possibility, and joy.
Yeah, and you write about how, like, this idea that we are just, and you mentioned it earlier, that we are just primed for learning. Like a child is a learner, you know, it's just evolution has primed us for learning, just as like many other mammals and species, like we are primed to learn. Can you just talk a little bit more about this? Because I think it's so important to understand this piece of our development.
Yeah, the way I like to put it is that we are really primed to educate ourselves. And there's a number of basic drives that we have. They're just absolutely obvious that all children come into the world with these drives, unless they've got very severe brain damage of some sort. But the two most prominent drives, the ones most obviously the educative drives, as I refer to them, are curiosity and playfulness. So there's really two aspects to education when you think about it. One is the acquisition of knowledge and information, the acquisition of what's out there and what can I do with those things and what are the properties of these things in my world, including the inanimate things and including the people in my world and so on and so forth. We're just naturally curious about things. Babies, as soon as they're born, are already, as soon as their eyes can fix it, a few hours old, they're already exploring their environment. There's research showing this. By the time they can crawl, why are they crawling? Why are they moving? They're moving to get to things so that they can explore them. That's why we have to baby-proof our house, because they want to get into everything. Not because they're naughty, but because they're curious. They want to understand, what's this thing in my world? What can I do with it? What happens if I drop it on the floor? What happens if I stick a bobby pin in this electric outlet? And so on and so forth. So therefore, we have to baby-proof our house. But and then as children get older, this curiosity expands to even wider parts of their environment if we don't kill it. Unfortunately, we tend to kill it in school. And then the other primary drive for education is play. So curiosity is the drive to acquire information and understanding about the world you're growing up in. Play is the drive for skills. Play is practice in skills. So when children are playing, they're doing things. They are practicing. In fact, their anthropologists point out that throughout the world, in places where children have ample opportunities to play, they play at all the basic skills that are important to humans everywhere. They play at language, they play socially, they play in ways that stretch their emotional capacities, they play in ways that develop courage because they're somewhat fearful, they play in ways that help them learn how to control anger because they get angry in play, they play in ways that allow them to exercise their imagination and their creativity. They play in ways that allow them to exercise their logical abilities, which is part of imagination. They play in really, and they also tend to play at whatever are the important tools in their culture. So in a hunter-gatherer culture, the kids tend to play with bows and arrows and digging sticks and fire. And agricultural culture, they play with agricultural instruments they become good at. In our culture, what do they play with? They play with computers, far and away the most important tool of our culture.
Yeah, so, that would be that. But I was just having you say that made me think, like, when I grew up, I had all these, there was like a boat building place near where I lived, and there were cars. And the two things we played out constantly were like, we were on a boat and we were falling off, and then there was like this rusted out old convertible and we played in that car constantly. It was the boat, right? And the car, those were important, the vehicles. But now it's the computers.
Now, yeah, I mean, it's not just the computer, but yeah. the computer is far and away the most obvious tool of our culture. I mean, anybody who looks around, any kid looking around will say, no matter what I'm going to do in this world that I'm growing up in, I'm going to have to be skilled at computers. I may or may not need to be skilled at this or that, depending on my interest, depending on my direction, but no matter what I do, computers are going to be involved.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Okay. So we have this drive for play. And one of the, and I wanted to talk to you now, kind of shift into this idea between schooling and education. Well, you talk about this, right? You talk about there's a difference between schooling and education. So what is that difference? And how, in your mind, can school interfere with education then?
So the way I define education is as follows. I actually define it somewhat differently for different audiences, but usually when I define it, when I'm not talking to anthropologists, I define education as everything that a person learns that enables that person to live a satisfying and meaningful and moral life. So isn't that what we all want for our kids?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the essence of education. Everything that you learn, no matter where you learn it, no matter how you learn it, that helps you to live a satisfying, meaningful, and moral life. So it's not exactly the same as learning, because you can learn a lot of stuff that doesn't help you live your life. You can learn trivia, you can learn nonsense, you can learn bad habits, you can learn things that aren't true. You can learn things that have no relevance to your life and you're going to forget it, which is primarily what you're learning in school. And that doesn't contribute to your education. What contributes to your education is those things that you learn that really help you in the long run of your life. So that's the way I define education. And I think almost everybody, if they think about it that way, finds that to be a meaningful definition of education. That's what you would want for yourself. That's what you would want for your kids. So then the question is, well, where does that learning come from? And I think that if you or I or any adult examines your own, what are the things that I know? What are the things that have been useful to me in my life? That you would find that most of it didn't occur in school. Some of it occurred in school. We spent a lot of time in school. So of course, you know, we learned some things there that stayed with us. But by and large, what we have learned that stayed with us are those things that we encountered in the course of our regular everyday life and that are therefore meaningful because they're part of regular life, and those things that we encountered because we developed our own curiosity about them. We developed an interest in them. We developed a real interest in them. And as a consequence of that interest, we explored them and played with them in ways that we incorporated into our real being. That lasts with us, that plays a role, for example, in our choice of future career and our ability to do that career. It plays a role in whether or not we have a happy marriage, that plays a role in whether or not we're able to make good friends. All these things that that really do contribute to a satisfying and meaningful and moral life are the things that that we've acquired because of life experience and because of the things that we have chosen to pursue on our own initiative. And so that's self-directed education. That self-directed education is the education that comes from living your life and from exploring and playing with the things that interest you.
And I'm imagining like a listener here who's a teacher maybe of young kids, and maybe that question might be, but kids need to be exposed to lots of different things to be able to know the things that they are interested in, to explore. Maybe bristling at the idea that school could interfere with this idea of education. What do you say to someone like that?
Well, see, school interferes with it because it takes all your time. You don't have time to explore your own interests. And you can't really, and school today doesn't, school suppresses curiosity. School suppresses play. There's no way that you can have a classroom of 20 or 30 kids or more, and everybody's going to be curious about the same thing at the same time. That's just not possible. And so therefore, the school has to operate and does operate on the basis everybody's supposed to be doing the same thing at the same time in the same way. there's no way that the kids, you know, maybe 10% of the time you will find something that you're curious about in that, but 90% of the time, no, you know, you're just doing it. It's a chore. And so curiosity, real curiosity, is disruptive in the classroom. It's the kid who asks questions that are not in line with the lesson because the kid is curious. That kid is a disruptor of the classroom. And that kid who challenges the teacher's perspective on things because that kid wants to really know, you know, that kid gets shot down in one way or another, inevitably. And I don't blame the teachers for it. They couldn't handle that. They couldn't, you know, that's why my son was not possible for him to go to school. The teachers could not handle his curiosity, could not handle the fact he could figure out ways of doing things and he wanted to do it in his way. That was not possible in school. and I'm totally sympathetic with those teachers. I'm also sympathetic with my son. So that's the reality. Play, if it occurs at all in school, is recess, which has been diminished to almost nothing in school anyway. And it was always regarded as a break from education, not the education. This is just, there used to be an acknowledge kids need some time to play. We don't acknowledge that anymore, but we used to acknowledge that. And so we would give recess a couple times a day and at noon. And, but nobody ever thought that was really part, or very few people thought that was really part of the child's education. So isn't it interesting? We deprive children of their natural means of educating themselves, curiosity and play. And then we force them through a curriculum using reward and punishment as the means. And the primary reward is praise, you're doing better than other people. And the primary punishment is shame, you failed or you're not doing as well as other people. And then we wonder why kids are so anxious.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. I mean, I guess my caveat is, having been a founder of a public charter Montessori school and having my kids go through that system is amazing. The way they get they have a way to help 25 kids do individual work that they are interested in and that they get to choose, which I think is very, very cool. So I think there's a lot to learn from that. But one of the reasons I reached out to you to talk again this time was because I was walking in my neighborhood. And I noticed that just right in my little funky little town, there is a Sudbury school that has opened in the Ardens in Delaware. And I had seen some kids there because like my community garden is like attached to the building. And I think there's like a homeschooling group there. I think there's this. And then it turns out there's a Sudbury school there. I went and looked up the site and I found a video from a YouTube video from you talking about learning there. And so a Sudbury school, maybe you can explain kind of what that model is. And it's where you sent your son to school when he was too curious for the traditional classroom, right?
Yeah. So I got interested in all of this many, many years ago when my son had been rebelling in the public school he was going to, and the only school he was willing to go to, I didn't exactly send him there, he sent me there, was the Sudbury Valley School, which turned out to be just a couple miles from where we lived. And at that time, he was 9 years old. At that time, that was considered walking distance for a nine-year-old. So that was very convenient. But this was a radically alternative school. This was not like... this was much more radically alternative than, say, a Montessori school is. Yeah. So this is a school that there are kids there from age four on through what we think of as high school age, onto the mid to late teenage years. The kids are not segregated in any way from one another or from the staff. The staff don't regard themselves as teachers. They don't call themselves teachers because they don't believe they do any more teaching than anybody else in the school does. There's no curriculum. There's no tests. There's no academic requirements. The school is run democratically by the school meeting. So, and the school meeting consists of all the staff and the students. And they meet once a week and make the rules of the school. The rules have nothing to do with academic learning. The rules all have to do with behavior that, you know, basically any group of people needs rules so that you don't interfere with what one another is doing. You don't destroy property. You don't hurt one another. You don't litter. You don't, all of these kinds of rules that are developed through the school meeting, and the rules are enforced democratically through a procedure that's similar to our judicial system in the United States. There's essentially a jury that gets formed. If you're serving on that, what's called the judicial committee, you're serving for a couple of weeks. That may change over time, but. And that consists of representatives from every large age group. There's usually a couple of little kids, a couple of middle-sized kids, and a couple of teenagers, and a staff member on the judicial committee at any given time. If you violate a rule and somebody brings you up to it, this is the group that determines whether you truly violated the rule or not and what the consequences should be if you did violate the rule. So that's how the school runs. And so there's no, if you were to visit the school at any time of day, knowing only that it's a school, you would probably assume it's recess time. And somehow this is a school where all the kids have recess at the same time.
I ran into the group at my local school. They were sitting by the creek. I was biking by and they're sitting by the creek and in the rocks on the creek. I was like, oh, there's the Sudbury School.
That's right. So you'd see kids out by the creek. On the Sudbury Valley has a pond. It's located adjacent to a state park. So there's a wooded area that the kids play in. There's rocks that they climb. It's a great outdoor space. They're very lucky to have that great outdoor space. But indoors, there's all kinds of things that you can do. What the school does is it offers all sorts of opportunities for doing things and learning from what you're doing, but it doesn't require anybody to do it. If a child wants to just sit there and do nothing, nobody will tell them, don't you think you should do something? The belief is that human beings are such that that boredom sort of stirs the soul. You'll start doing something at some point. And that you're not doing a child a favor by getting them to do something because you want them to do something. You have to wait until they want to do it. That's the philosophy of the school. So my first study of the school many, many years ago was motivated partly, but maybe I would say primarily, by my concern about my son. Like any parent at that time, I was concerned about, you know, it was clear that this was the only school he was going to go to. But I was concerned, you know, what if he stayed here all the way through high school, his high school age? They don't have anything officially called high school. What would his adult life be like? Would he be able to go to college if he wanted to? Is he necessarily destined to become a starving artist or musician? You know, so the school had already been in existence long enough that there were about something like 80 or 90 graduates of the school who were out there in the real world, had been out there for at least a couple of years. And so I did a study of the graduates of the school, and along with a part-time staff member at the school who helped me find them and participated also in some of the interviews of the students. And what we found was that the graduates of school were doing very well out there in the world, including those who had never been to another school. All of their education, all of their schooling, I should say, was at the Sudbury Valley School. And it turns out they didn't have any problem going on to college if they wanted to go. Some of them even went directly into fairly prestigious colleges. They were in the whole range of careers, including a math professor, including people in law, people in business, although most of the business people are people who had started their own businesses. They were in the human services. They were in every career that we value in our culture. They were they essentially all seemed to be happy with their life. In response to a question about whether they were glad or not glad that they had attended such an unusual school, every single one in that group said they were glad. And most said very glad, which was a choice. And when we asked them about why they were glad they had attended such a school, it was because the reasons tended to be the following. Number one, I enjoyed my childhood. You know, childhood is an important part of life. You know, it's a big part of life. And we should pay more attention to whether children are enjoying that part of their life. So that was maybe the first thing they said. And then they said, and I learned to take control of my life because nobody else was telling me what to do. I had to learn how to take control. And I had to learn how to ask for help if I wanted help. And I'm not afraid of asking for help. I learned how to take responsibility for myself. I don't go around thinking of myself as a victim in this world, as this is me talking now, as so many people do. I think of myself as in control of myself. And this is a great benefit. This helped me in college. This helped me in my career. And many of them talked about social skills because they had so much time to talk with one another, to socialize. The teenagers spend a lot of time socializing. The little kids spend a lot of time actively playing. The teenagers spend time actively playing and doing things and get involved in hobbies, but they also spend a lot of time talking things out with one another. And as a consequence, they're learning about themselves. They're learning, and they're also developing social skills. And because in this school, the adults don't have any more official power than the kids do, they've learned to talk to adults in a kind of equal way, and they've found this valuable. They would say things like, I'm not afraid to go and talk to my professor and disagree with my professor if I disagree. And we have an interesting conversation. My professor seems to value the fact that I'm not afraid of expressing my views and having a discussion with him about something that's of mutual interest to us. So these are some of the things that that I found in the graduates, which I see as very different from the typical college students that I was teaching at the same time in my university career.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tiny humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter-Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests, too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
It sounds awesome. I mean, it sounds like exactly what I would want for my kids. It's so interesting, that whole idea of like the relative equality between the adults and the kids versus like where people value a hierarchy between adults and kids. In a Montessori school, they call the adults by their first name and they say hello and shake hands. Even if you're 2 years old, you say hello and shake hands at the door. It's really cute. But my kids are 12 and 15 now, and my 15-year-old just did a presentation for the town meeting, which was sort of contentious about her Eagle Scout project, and she could do it. You know, it was a tough situation, and she could do it. And I was really psyched for her. But I've always felt uncomfortable when sometimes I've had friends say, have their child call me, you know, Ms. Hunter or Mrs., you know, or something like that. And I feel very, very uncomfortable with it. But there are some people want that hierarchy and feel that that is beneficial. But you're saying that one of the benefits of maybe not having that hierarchy, having more equality between ages, is that your children then will become more comfortable talking to people who are ostensibly like at a different power level than them, and that can help them in their life.
Right. I think that's right. And I think that, and the combination of that and the sense of taking responsibility for yourself, one of the biggest complaints we get today, both from college professors and from employers of young adults, is that they want to be told exactly what to do. They don't seem to know how to say, this is my job to figure out what to do. This is my job to figure out what I want to write this term paper on and how I'm going to do it and so on and so forth. This is my job to, you know, my boss has given me this assignment. It's my job to figure out how to do this assignment. It's not his job to tell me in point by point detail how to do it. Mm-hmm. These are the kinds of things that kids who've had a lot of chance to play, who've had a lot of chance to engage in their own projects, who've been in charge of their own life are good at, but our spoon feeding school system, you know, where we're telling them exactly what to do all the time, and we're grading them on whether they do it the way we told them to do it. Creativity is punished. We're teaching exactly the wrong thing. I mean, one of the things that drove my son crazy was that he was in public school through fourth grade, and the only way he could make the arithmetic class interesting was to find his own way of solving the problems. And even though he got the answers right, the teacher would count it wrong because he didn't do it the right way.
That's so funny, because nowadays that's what they teach, or at least that's what they taught my girls, is they teach them many different ways to solve the problems. And they would come home maybe or they would show me some work they were doing. And I would say, the only way I know how to do this is this one way. And they would know four different ways to do it. It's really interesting.
It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we can see like there's these problems with like our traditional school system, right? We know our traditional school system came out of like wanting to create workers for the industrial jobs, right? Isn't that kind of the roots of our school system, like kind of creating obedient workers for the jobs? And that's where the Bell system came along and all of that. So it's kind of like the way I see it is this is a giant boat that is impossible to sort of turn around in another direction, or it's really hard to turn around the other direction. But for a lot of people, it may be their only choice out there. I was talking to somebody in the community, in the Mindful Mama podcast community, and she was saying, oh my God, my child's going to kindergarten. They're doing all this reward and punishment. She's getting stars for this and all of these behavior things. And it's making her daughter anxious. And she's like, but I don't know what to do about it, you know? And people are, it can be hard to know what to do about it. I mean, I imagine like you don't have that answer, I'm sure. But like, what is the vision for like, how can we maybe bring some of these what is your vision for what it could look like? You know, I mean, would everybody everywhere have a Sudbury style school, or could we find something that's like a hybrid? I mean, to meet our kids' needs in a healthier, more holistic way, where they keep that curiosity and they are in control of their education.
Yeah, it's so much hard to find a hybrid that works well, but I think what's happening, my view of what's happening, is that we are moving in the direction that school as we know it is becoming increasingly obsolete. That might not be apparent to everybody, but the number of people homeschooling is greatly increasing in the United States. It's been increasing over decades, but in very recent times, partly because of COVID, admittedly, it has really jumped up to about 11% of American families with school-age children are homeschooling their kids. Most of the people, early on, homeschooling was primarily motivated by religious interests. People wanted to give their child a religious education, or by parents who were kind of high achievement parents who thought they could do a better job of teaching the academic stuff and getting their kids into a fancy college than the school could. Nowadays, more and more people are doing it because they recognize the harm that's being done to their children in school. They see it. They see the child becoming, they see this child who is happy and sociable becoming depressed, anxious, even in elementary school, even in kindergarten. And they're making a decision, this clearly is not good for my child. Or their child is getting some kind of a crazy diagnosis of ADHD or some darn thing, and the recommendation of taking a drug, and the parents realize that this is not good for my child, and they take the child out. So more and more parents are doing it because they recognize the harm to their children. As more and more parents are doing this, it becomes easier for other parents to do it, and it becomes easier for homeschooling parents as more in any given area, in any given city or town, more and more people are doing it. It becomes possible to have more and more opportunities available so that the kids aren't just at home. Homeschooling is really a misnomer. It shouldn't be called homeschooling. It's community schooling. It's you can't get educated just at home. That would be a bad thing, right? So it's but you need to get involved with the community. You need to have other kids to play with. You need to get involved with age-mixed interactions. You need all of this. But the more people who are homeschooling, the more this becomes possible. So one of the things that's happening is that libraries are beginning to pick up on this. More and more libraries are now offering special opportunities for homeschoolers to get together. They're not limited to homeschoolers, but homeschoolers take the biggest advantage of them. And some of them are held during the school day. So there it is, just homeschoolers. They are developing, many libraries now have makerspaces in them, so you can engage in constructive play, building things, and it's the kids who are taking biggest advantage of this. There are many libraries, I've got an article in press in the American Journal of Play on this, there are many libraries that now are offering free play at the library, age-mixed free play. So they're becoming centers in some sense for play and self-directed education generally. I have a vision that this is kind of this is a gradual change, but this is a wave of the future. The other thing that I think is encouraging is that we are seeing an increasing number of apprenticeships available for kids, for young people. There are many businesses now that are recognizing that there's no advantage to them to hire a college graduate. The people aren't learning that much in college. Most people are learning almost nothing in college that's relevant to the job. And so they find that they're better off training bright young people who are very motivated for the job in an apprenticeship. So the young people are actually making money instead of paying money for their education. And the number of official apprenticeships in the United States doubled over a recent five-year period. And probably had been increasing before then. And that's just the official ones. There are many other ones that are not registered with the U.S. Department of Labor. So I think these are very hopeful trends. Part of what drives all this obsession about grades and so on is the belief that everybody's got to go to college, and the fancier the college you can get them into, the better off they will be, which has never been true. But it's becoming more and more obviously not true.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it in fact that kids who go to Ivy League schools, mentally, emotionally, their emotional health is worse in some ways, right? Aren't there some studies about that?
Well, there are studies of I think that is true. What I definitely know is true is that because there's a lot of research that's primarily by Sonoya Luther is the person who's done this research, that the kids high school kids who are suffering the most are the ones in the so-called high achievement schools. So these are the schools, they tend to be in wealthy neighborhoods or they're private schools where you're paying pretty high tuition to send your kids there, where everybody believes they have to get into a fancy college or they're a failure. Everybody believes you've got to take all the honors classes or you're a failure. Everybody believes if you get anything less than an A, you're a failure. This becomes incorporated into each person's own judgment of themselves. And these are the kids who are committing suicide at the highest rates. These are the kids who are, you know, I'll never make it in life because I failed that. I got a B in that course. Can you imagine that? But that's the way many people think. And so it's interesting to me that the very kinds of schools that so many parents want to get their kids into, people will pay a premium to live in a neighborhood that has one of these high achieving schools in it. They want to send their kids to that, but this is where kids are suffering the most. And those kids who go to those schools are also, they're following up in college, they're also suffering in college. They are more likely to commit suicide, more likely to suffer mental breakdowns in college than kids who went to not such high achieving schools. So I believe it's probably the case. I can't point to a research study that shows it, but I believe it's probably the case that the biggest emotional crises are occurring at the fanciest colleges.
It's amazing. You know, so dear listeners, you're hearing this, you know, this is some incredibly important information. Like the things that we were told are supposed to work aren't true, right? Like this, like the good grades, the intensive program, that kind of thing is actually harder on our kids. It makes me, I'm like bragging on my kid today, but I'm so proud of her because she went after the Montessori school ended in eighth grade, she went to our local high school and it happens to have an IB program, International Baccalaureate, which is this prestigious, intense program where it's equivalent to these schools in Europe, et cetera. And she chose not to do that program, even though she's like kind of in some ways an ideal kid for it because she didn't want to have all the homework and do all that stuff and was really interested in the German, things like that. So I don't know. So I guess what I want to invite you, dear listener, is to think about is how can we take this information and whatever situation you're in, whether you have some school choice, whether you have the privilege and the ability to be able to have the things in your life available to homeschool your kids, or whether you have, you know, or whether maybe you have very little choice in this matter because of work situations and location and things like that. How can you take some of this and think about, well, how can I increase time for play without adults around, without maybe screens around? Although I don't know, you know, and time for these things that, you know, are so essential for this development, right? For a satisfying, meaningful, and moral life. I mean, what are the things we want to increase? I'm thinking about these things, Peter. You know, if we're looking at people who maybe have very little choice in the matter as far as schooling or very limited options.
So I think if your child is going to a public school, to a conventional school, I think what you need to do, what I would recommend doing, is don't add to the stress, subtract to the stress. You know, I've said this before. My own mother had this attitude that she would not look at the report cards that I and my brothers brought home. She wouldn't look at them. She said,
"I don't look at. I barely look at my.
Good for you. I'll sign it. I've got to sign it. I know I've got to sign it, but this is your business. It's not mine."
I love that. Go
and so there's no stress from home about it. There's no I think that get off of this thing that, and this is partly driven by parents, but it's also partly driven by the internalized fears and anxieties that children themselves have about their future, especially high school age kids, that they have internalized this view that if they don't get to a fancy college, if they don't, that somehow their life is going to be ruined, that somehow they will. So this is a myth, and it's important to get over this myth. In fact, there is research, I've summarized it in a blog post, that shows, these are carefully done studies that show that kids who go to a non-prestigious college do just as well in life by every measure, including income at age 40, which is the standard measure of success. It's the wrong measure in my view, but it is a standard measure of success, including income at age 40, as kids who've gone to the fancy college, if you control for other variables. So of course, Harvard kids make more money than kids from the local state college because they come from richer families. And if you come from a rich family, you're already set up to make a lot of money, right? Also, the typical Harvard kid is somebody who's very achievement motivated, very focused, very hardworking. If you take a kid who has those same qualities and they go to the local state college, they also do just as well in life. So it's because they're different to begin with that you get the correlation between, you know, going to Harvard or going. But if you control for those other things, then the kids who go to the typical state college that's relatively non-selective, pretty much anybody can go there, do just as well in life. You're paying less tuition for it. I think there are different advantages of the two and that they somewhat cancel one another out. The advantage of going to the lesser college is that you're kind of a big fish in a small pond. You're noticed by the professors. You get good letters of recommendation. You're more likely to be invited in by a professor to work with them in the laboratory. You're more likely to get to know your professors on a first name basis than if you go to an Ivy League college where the professors are involved with their graduate students, but not much with their undergraduate students. So that's part of it. And there's also the typical kid who goes to Harvard or that kind of school, they've been tops in their class in high school, then suddenly they're not anymore. Suddenly they're, see, I'm just average here. I'm just, or maybe worse than average. And that has blow to your self-esteem in a way that blow could be healthy, but it's often unhealthy. It often leads to depression. It often leads to a sense of I'm no good after all, you know, and so that's the those things kind of cancel them out. But what the data show is that you are just overall, you're just as well off going to the lesser college, and some argue better off based on the data, but I'm not convinced by that. But I think overall equally well off. So if people can realize that, and then the other thing that's happening, as I said before, with more and more apprenticeships, there's less and less reason to go to college at all. It's still the case that there are careers that the way we've got things set up pretty much require college. If you want to be a doctor, you've pretty much got to get a bachelor's degree first and before you go to medical school. I'm looking for that to change, but it hasn't changed yet. So there are certain careers where you're going to have to go to college to pursue them. But there are many very well-paying careers that don't require college, and most students aren't aware of that. So when I look at, one of the ways I've learned this is by looking at what the graduates of Sudbury schools have done and looking at what grown unschoolers have done, because I've also done studies of grown unschoolers. These are homeschoolers who are in control of their own education. And they find these amazing careers that don't require college if they don't, you know, and they go to college if they feel they need to, if they want to be a doctor or they want to be a lawyer or something that requires college. But they find amazing careers that they love and are well paying that don't require college. And so you don't even hear about this if you've just been going to school.
Well, and this all points to what you write about, which is this idea of the trust, being a trustful parent. But dear listener, we don't have time to talk about that. So you're going to have to get Peter Gray's book, Free to Learn, and dive in deeper into this. There's fascinating studies and all these like stories. It's really fascinating. But I think what you are pointing to is this idea of like, let's parent from trust and not from fear, right? Let's parent from like, you are capable, you are smart, you can do all the things you want to do. And rather than, oh my God, are you enough? You need these accreditations, you need more, you need this, you need that. That's kind of what I'm hearing from you.
I think that's right. You know, and I think one way that parents can think about it is really what is your honest, heartfelt dream for your child? And when I ask people that and I ask them to really think about it and think deeply, they usually come up with things like, you know, I want my child to be comfortable in their own skin. I want them to I want them to be good neighbors to whoever they're neighbors to. I want them to be loving parents if they have children. I want them to be good friends to their friends. I want them to add more to the world than they take away from it. I think most parents genuinely want that for their kids. They don't, when they think about it, it's not like, you know, my whole goal for my child is that they get an Ivy League education. If they really think about it, if they think about it from their heart as well as their mind. And I think that that's maybe the first step towards altering some of the harmful things that we're doing to children.
Peter, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again, because you haven't been on this podcast, but we've talked before, and I really, really enjoy it. I really appreciate the work that you've done and the way, you know, the writing you've done. Peter is also a founder of letgrow.org. We've had past guests, Lenore Skenazy, on, who is working in that organization as well. I appreciate what you do enormously, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come and talk to us today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. This is such a meaningful episode. I think he, you know, just helps us understand about how kids learn so much more. And I love this invitation to move into this trustful parenting role. So beautiful. Listen, if you haven't done so yet, please hit that subscribe button and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. It makes such a big difference. And if you love this episode, please do me a favor, share it on your Instagram stories and tag me in it at Mindful Mama Mentor. And I will see you there and be offering you your feed, some mindful parenting inspiration. And yeah, I'm wishing you a great week, my friend. As I said, I'm going to be with Peter Gray. I'm going to be speaking with him at a big international parenting conference. I'll be talking about how to stop yelling, and it's called Parenthood the Unconference, and it'll be in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. And you can learn more about that at parenthooduc.com. That's parenthooduc.com. So if you want to go, I'd love to see you there. Maybe we can meet up. That'd be so cool. I'm wishing you a great week, my friend. I hope you have some sunshine. Boy, we've been like 6 days of rain, so that you can see a little sun outside. It's making my heart sing. I wish you lots of hugs and plenty of sleep and all the good things in life. So I can't wait to talk to you again next week. Thank you so much for listening. Namaste.
Are you overwhelmed by the things that get in the way of you doing what you want to do? Are you looking for ways to simplify life to better align with your values? Do you want to create space in your schedule so you have room for more of the good stuff? Play, joy, relationships, gratitude, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I invite you to check out Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of super smart, compassionate, and thoughtful guests, you'll come away with big picture insights and practical ways to declutter your home, schedule, and mental space without getting bogged down by perfection. I have always believed that small moments and actions matter tremendously. My goal is to help you find agency and space in your life through doable baby steps that will leave you feeling accomplished instead of overwhelmed. Check out Edit Your Life wherever you enjoy your podcasts.